Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for subscribing and thanks for those 5-star reviews.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. If it's your first time listening, we're glad you're here. After you listen and you enjoy what you're listening to, because we know you will, go back and subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you found us on. Subscribe to us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter, and follow us on YouTube.
For sure. And thank you to everyone that's supporting the podcast, that's clicked that link on there, because we've got a couple live shows coming up and they're going to be epic. We've got the gear. It's going to be really cool. I can't wait to get some of these veterans out there face to face. And hey, who we got on the phone today? We're going to talk about a significant event that I think everyone's going to recognize. We've got Commander Tim T.J. Smits. Originally from Medina, Ohio, graduate of Emory-Riddle University, prior Chief Warrant Officer in the Army, joined the Coast Guard with the Direct Commissioned
Aviator
Program back in 2001, first assigned to Air Station Detroit, close to my, in one of my units up in Marblehead, then assigned to the Alaska Patrol, ALPAT, in Kodiak, Alaska, flying HH-65 still, went from there to Air Station Houston. During the tour at some point, got picked up for grad school, went to the University of Houston for IT project management. That sounds like setting yourself up for a really good
post-Coast Guard job.
And then to the Aviation Logistics Center as an HH-60 engineer, then to the schoolhouse at Aviation Training Technical Center, I think at ATTC Mobile, as the XO, and now as the engineering officer at Hitron, where he's flying or learning to fly the HH-65Ds.
All over again,
right. And with that, I'll let Bill ask the question.
All right, good morning, sir. What's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, good morning, and thank you for the introduction. We've been kind of going back and forth like the last couple of months trying to set this interview up, and I finally had time. And again, I appreciate the invite to be on the show. So one of the cases I wanted to talk about this morning, as you kind of alluded to, was the sinking of the Alaska Ranger in 2008. Some background on the story. As we talked about my career, I was in Detroit, then I went from Detroit to ALPAT, which kind of set me up for that cold weather operating environment. And I had been in ALPAT for about a year, and I was looking at the deployment schedule, and I had an option of going on a cutter for I think it was a 30-day deployment in the wintertime or early spring, and then I had an opportunity to go on the Monroe for 45. I had done a prior deployment on the Monroe, and I was like, sign me up, I'll go to the Monroe any day. It was a fantastic crew, good skipper and just well, well prepared for that type of environment. So that's kind of how I ended up on the Moreau in 2008, in March of 2008. The patrol was any typical patrol. Again, the captain was very a seasoned Alaska sailor, and a storm was coming in from Russian Peninsula. So he elected to take the Monroe up towards St. Paul Island on the edge of the ice to give us, one, great sailing conditions, out of the wind, out of heavy seas. And his thought process is, well, anything happens with the crab fleet or the fishing fleet south of us, you know, we'll have following seas. We can get to, you know, we can get on scene fast, get on scene faster.
And how does that work, Tim? Like the, so at the edge of the ice field, I mean, you're probably one of the few people I know that's ever been that far north. So is it just, you're talking like completely frozen, you know, just an ice field?
Yeah, it's an ice field. It's packed ice. So it's a little broken up. But what it does is it, you know, the wind isn't able to grab the surface of the water.
Right.
So it's calm. So you may have 35 knot, 40 knot winds, and the ice is moving around, but you're not getting that wave action.
Right.
So Captain Lloyd basically pulled the boat up right towards the edge of the ice, and we kind of hung out there for 2 days doing some log runs back and forth to St. Paul in preparation for, you know, for Easter Sunday and the morale day we had on Saturday prior to, because Sunday was going to be a down day because it was Easter. That night, Saturday night, the crew put together a morale event to raise money and you know, have fun. And one of the events, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, it's called the Number 10 Can Challenge.
I'm looking forward to hearing what this is.
So the Number 10 Can Challenge is they take the big, you know, 10-pound cans of whatever it is, beets, beans, applesauce, lima beans, and they rip the labels off. And then you have I think it's a 3 or 4 man team. I didn't participate, but my crew members did. And so they're competing for a prize, and the prize is awarded to the team that can finish the can first. And they had no idea what they're eating. So the team's inner.
So that could be beets, or it could be applesauce. Like that, yeah.
It could be applesauce. It could be tomato. Anything. So I think 3 or 4 of my crew entered the competition. They, you know, they rip the labels off the cans. They don't know what it is. And they pick your can. They pick their can out, and my guys get baked beans. And so they proceed to eat this, you know, Number 10 can of baked beans. I don't think they won. It was a valid effort. They did really well.
Valid effort.
Like whoever gets the applesauce wins automatically.
Yeah, that's it. You just won.
Well, usually it's never something good like that.
Right.
I'm trying to remember some of the stuff. And usually it involves, you know, like one team. Like pickles. Pickles is one of them.
Oh, man, that'd be rough. Yeah, that would be rough.
Well, yeah, so there's trash cans really available for people that can't hang, that can offload, so to speak.
It's so funny that I was actually going to ask you, like, hey, what's a morale day for Easter Sunday look like on a cutter? And I was like, they're probably just, like, knocked off work, not doing anything. But who would have known? They're actually, there's a little competition action. I like it.
Yeah, that was the night before. So they really pumped it up. Morale did a really great job. And, again, the crew on that ship was absolutely phenomenal. And it goes back to, you know, me saying, hey, I'll go an extra 15 days if I get to go on that ship. And,
right.
And that's all, I guess that's how we ended up there. So they finished the competition, and everybody kind of went to bed that night. It was like I said, calm seas, and about 2:30 in the morning, my phone rings in my stateroom, and it was the ops boss saying, hey, I need you to come down to CIC. We have a possible case. And I'm thinking, okay, we're pretty much in the middle of nowhere. So I make my way down to, CIC, and I'm listening to the HF radio chatter. And I hear, you know, a call going back and forth between, I think, the vessel, the Alaska Ranger, and Kodiak. And they're going through, you know, their initial calls, you know, what the issue is. And initial call was, hey, you know, it's a 189-foot catcher processor, 47 souls on board, you know, taking on water. And I'm thinking to myself, it's like, how far away are they? Like, at this point, they're like, I think 90 miles away. It's like, wow, that's pretty far out there. Maybe 120. And I knew there was a 60 in St. Paul. So I figured, hey, you know, they're going to get all the glory. Probably go out there, deliver a dewatering pump. No big deal. Stayed down at CSE for a little bit longer, kind of listened to the comms back and forth, and heard, I think, Kodiak was going to launch the 60 from St. Paul, and I figured it's going to take us 4 hours to get there steaming by ship. And at that point, I wasn't really, you know, risk versus gain, you know, hey, do you launch that far out, you know, out of limits? You know, we knew it was windy out, but we didn't understand how rough the ocean was because of the fact that we were right on the ice edge. Within about 35 minutes, that scenario changed when the Alaska Ranger, you know, basically said, it, you know, it went from taking on water to their abandoning ship. Obviously, you know, the boats, you know, had already spooled up. They started firing the turbines. They started heading south to scene. And that went from, you know, a high risk, low gain to a high risk, high gain, you know, type scenario. Went down and had the flip mech wake up the swimmer. And, you know, kind of, you know, had the discussion about, you know, how do we execute this SAR case? It wasn't, you know, something we were obviously anticipating. It just kind of fell in our lap. So that's how I guess the whole, you know, the whole scenario kind of started.
And how many people were on the ship, did they say?
Yeah, it was 47 people.
47. So, and then you guys can hoist, what can a 65 hoist at any one sortie, I guess, any one flight?
Well, typically, we are limited to, you can probably get three people in the cabin. It's just really tight. And depending on how big the survivors are, you know, you have weight restrictions, you have, you know, performance issues with the airplane and what it can do. So we had discussed, hey, you know, how do we, you know, execute this SAR case? One of the things we had discussed doing was taking a mass casualty raft with us, which allows, you know, you can put a lot of people in that. And I believe the H-60 had taken one, so we're like, I'd rather have more fuel than extra, you know, raft on board. So we had the discussion as we were steaming south to, you know, max fuel the H-65. And just take our standard crew.
And you guys get to make that call, right, Commander? Like, that's your call to make as to how you're going to kind of prosecute that mission at that point?
Yeah, so, yeah. And obviously, you know, you have other supporting agencies. You know, District was involved at that point. Kodiak was involved. District was trying to set up a mass casualty scenario in Dutch Harbor to receive all these survivors. But the issue we had for us, there's no way we were going to make it to St. Paul or to make it to Dutch Harbor from our location. You know, if we took off, we had to go back to the boat. We were just too far offshore. Right. And we knew that. The H-60 had an option to go to Dutch Harbor. But the issue with that is they're going to have to shut down, refuel, fuel back, you know, fuel up, start up, and then come back out. And as I'll talk later on, you know, we basically had the conversation in round and discussed, hey, go back to Monroe. They're ready to refuel you if needed. And they're able to actually hover next to the ship and take on fuel, which ironically, they had just practiced the day before. It wasn't the same crew, but it was the same aircraft.
What's the sea state at this point? Because you're getting away from the ice now. I imagine it's starting to turn into a nasty day out there.
Yeah, so at that point, you know, we started really pitching and rolling. They fired up the turbines, so we're beat feet south as fast as we could. And we're having a discussion, and I remember Captain Lloyd coming down, and we talked about, you know, warranted risk, abuse of the airframe, as far as, you know, probably over-torquing on takeoff.
Right.
You know, it was that, you know, we had worked together before. You know, he trusted my judgment and I trusted his crew, right. Basically what it boiled down to. And I kind of briefed him on, you know, but yeah, it got pretty nasty. I think, it was like 30 to 35 knot winds, 15 to 20 foot seas. And we're heading south and, you know, we're having discussions like, how do we get the helicopter outside to actually launch it? Cause at this point it's still in the hangar.
Right. And I'm just trying to imagine even the, you mentioned being able to refuel, you know, without the chopper actually landing, having done that on a relatively calm day, you know, from the deck side of the house, I can't imagine trying to grab that in the, and with the deck pitching up and down 15 or 20 feet at the same time.
Yeah. So that was, yeah, that's the 60 story to tell because they had a pipe, you know, again, they hyphered right. During the case. And we, you know, we elected obviously to land and just take fuel that way. But so we alerted the crew, and I remember, you know, we all got together and we're sitting there talking, and the swimmers was with me, and I said, hey, you know, make sure you put on an extra layer of undergarments just in case we decide to leave you on scene with the raft. And that small, you know, piece of information paid off huge dividends later on. So, you know, Abraham Heller went down, and he threw on an extra layer, and he came up, and, you know, I'm briefing the crew. It's like, okay, we got to get the helo out. So, you know, the ship obviously had to slow down and get into some kind of, you know, traversing limits for us as best as they could. And then we basically pushed the helo out. During that, I mean, that was a feat in itself.
I can only imagine, yeah.
The fact it didn't roll off the back of the boat. And one of the things that happened is the LSO was out there supervising everybody, and we got the helo in place, and they started putting the tie-down strap on, and then the LSO called, you know, helo secure on the deck. And as soon as he said that, I heard the turbines fire up, and we started heaving.
Oh, man.
You know, yeah. Heaving. And we, you know, the talon wasn't down yet. We only had two straps on. And I'm like, they hurried up and dropped the talon. And I was like, oh my gosh, this thing's going to roll off the back, you know? And, you know, luckily, you know, we avoided that scenario, and we proceeded to head south about 10 more miles as we went down to CIC to brief up the mission and what we were going to do and how it was going to kind of transpire. So, I remember going out and, you know, briefing the crew, the flight medic, the other pilot, and the rescue swimmer, and going out doing a walk around check. And there's like, you know, the Moro is still trying to, you know, close that gap as quick as they could with following seas. And, you know, there's green water coming over the back of the deck. There's, you know, ice started to build up on the fenestron because it's, you know, at this point it's, you know, it's 20 some degrees outside.
Right.
So anything that salt water hits, it just freezes to. And I remember climbing in the helicopter. I'm like, all right, well, this is it. And, you know, started going through the engine startup checks and getting ready to depart.
And how many people are on your crew, sir? Do you have a co-pilot and mech?
Crew of four. So it was myself, my co-pilot, our flight mechanic, and our rescue swimmer. So I remember, you know, we started up the helo and the ship stole, you know, letting us go through our checks, and they're heading south trying to close that distance. And I remember starting, you know, the number one engine up that morning, it's pitch black out. I mean, we're in Alaska in March, so sunrise isn't until probably 10:30 in the morning. And I looked down and I was like, oh wow, the number two engine, we have the generator or whatever is failed. We have an engine issue, you know. And my co-pilot looked at me, because at this point, you know, we've been up quite a bit. He's like, yeah, we haven't started that engine yet. I'm like, oh, thanks for backing me up. So we go through all our checks, and we called ready for takeoff, and the ship slowed down and turned into the seas, and at that point we were well outside of limits. They had closed the gap to, I think we're 80 miles from the last report of the position of the Alaska Ranger. And pitch black at night, MVG's on. You know, we already pre-briefed the crew that, yeah, we're probably going to over-torque on the way out and just try to keep it within a reasonable amount of exceedance so, you know, we continue on with the mission. And we basically, at that point, were kind of timing the swells and the waves and the rolls. To get a suitable configuration to take off. And what we noticed after about a minute sitting there is, you know, the boat would pitch up and then it would pitch down. And when it pitched down, obviously the stern lifted out and it kind of gave us a little bit of momentum. And we basically utilized that momentum to depart the ship.
Kind of springboard off, huh?
Yeah, basically. You know, kind of catapulted us off into the left, and we climbed out and started heading the scene. So.
I mean, how puckered are you when that happens? You know, like, I've moored a boat before and like kind of been like, man, this is a little sketchy.
I know what it's like being on the flight deck as, you know, that crew when it's like that and you're watching the helo take off and you're like, I'll just let everything go right.
Yeah, right.
Like, yeah. I guess I was glad it was really dark out because I couldn't see how bad it really was.
Right.
Hey, you know, we just... we're watching the NCDK, and I was like, oh, and, like I said, we were very fortunate. It worked out well for us. And then, once we got airborne, we started our transit onto scene. So,
sir, if I could interrupt you real quick, two questions for you. One, you said you're about 80 miles out, and then originally I think you were around 90.
Yeah.
So with that being said, and I know like that's you're saying at an uncomfortable range, like you can do it, but you don't have a lot of room for error there, I'm guessing. What is your kind of comfortable range in that kind of condition on the 65?
So part of the brief when we were down to CIC, once the ship sank, obviously it changed that dynamic.
Right.
The goal was to launch at about 80 miles. So at 90 miles, we traversed the helo out, came back down. They made up about another 10 miles. Like I said, the Monroe, they had one turbine. I think it was CASREP for emergency use only. That thing was going.
Right.
They're trying to get down there. And like I said, it goes back to the planning of the skipper. He's like, right, if I get into some situation where I have to respond, I'd rather be upwind and upswell, so right, I can move.
Right.
And So we looked at it. We knew we had to come back to the boat. So when we departed at our, 60 to 80 mile, that was our kind of my window, 60 to 80 miles.
Right. Knowing that the boat's going to be closing the whole time while you're on scene.
Exactly. As soon as we depart, we know they're going to close. And so one of the things we do in the 65 is when we depart the location for the boat, we basically mark that position. And
right,
it is our bingo. We are coming back to that spot. So we kind of plan for that. During our brief, we're like, they're probably going to close another 20 miles, so we'll figure 60 miles. So it gives me a little bit more, cushion,
right,
to kind of work with. So that kind of went into the planning phase of it. So at that point, okay, now we're heading south, and the 860 was trying to, they already picked up survivors, and they were trying to take them over to the Alaska Warrior, which is Alaska Ranger's sister ship, was a couple miles away. But the sea conditions were so bad, they couldn't even, hoist them down to the deck. So
right,
they had to stay on scene. And that's when we had the discussion with them, with like, hey, the Monroe is closing the distance. They have a Heifer rig ready to go. They can give you fuel. And that's when they made their decision, okay, we're going to go to the Monroe. And we kind of did one of these, like, passing in the night,
Right.
We saw them go out our port side, and we went out the starboard side. They were heading back to Monroe, and we were heading on scene.
Just a relay the whole time, right, sir?
Yeah, okay. Basically. They gave us, like, hey, what to expect? And they're like, what's the on-scene conditions? And they gave us right, the weather and winds.
I'm sorry, sir. I was going to say, before we go any further into the story, one other question I had, because I've heard it a lot, and I know that normally it means, like, that bird is done flying for a while, but without getting too deep in the weeds, if you could explain what over-torque is and what that normally means, when we're not in dire emergency.
Yeah, so basically you have engine limitations that you can pull up to, and then actually in the 65, it's not an engine limitation, it is a gearbox limitation. So when you say the magic number now in the 65 is 10. So once you exceed, 10 on the FLI or in that indicator, you basically over-torque the aircraft. And this says, hey, there's required maintenance you have to do if you exceed that. The higher above that number you go, the more maintenance you have to do, because then you start bending stuff or, you start stretching bolts, if that kind of makes sense. So,
right,
our goal was to keep it under the abort mission criteria. Or land as soon as practical criteria. I guess it's abort mission once you over torque, but there's a next criteria. It's like land as soon as practical, because you've probably done a little bit more damage to the aircraft. So our goal was to keep it under that, and we did.
Okay.
But I guess that's probably the best way to explain it.
Dude, not a question, right, for anybody, but a comment. Like, if sure, this story already doesn't make you proud to be associated with the Coast Guard, I don't know what will.
Right.
I mean, we got guys on ships, on aircraft.
Knowing he's going to break the aircraft and he's taking off anyway.
And like, doing this to save guys from a sinking right, vessel. Just, awesome. Anyway, sir, just had to get that out there. Little plug for the Coast Guard.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, the awesome, awesome organization. So, so we're going down there, and we understand that the 60 said, hey, what to expect, and like, there's strobe lights everywhere. There's some grouped together, and there's some off to the distance. And so one of the things, you know, we always talk about is like, hey, how much weight do we have? How much fuel? We have certain weight limitations we have. And I remember having a discussion with my co-pilot. I'm like, man, do you think we should dump fuel? And he's like, now let's see what happens like when we get there, which paid off huge in the end. You know, and when we finished the sortie, you know, we elected not to dump any fuel because we were really heavy, but we had plenty of wind available to us, so we wouldn't have to worry about over-torquing the aircraft, and we can, you know, we can basically sit there in a you know, somewhat steady hover at 35 knot headwind and be totally within our power margin. So we had that discussion. We also had a discussion, which worked out well for us, of deploying the rescue swimmer in the basket. So anytime you normally deploy a rescue swimmer is you know, you lower the swimmer down, then you bring the bare hook back up, you hook the basket up, and then you send the hook back down. And so, you know, we were going to be very time limited due to, one, the range we had to traverse, and also the condition of the survivors. So, you know, being in Alaska or being in Detroit before, you know, we knew that, you know, every minute that these guys and gals were in the water was, you know, one more minute that their survivability rate obviously drops. You know, at that point, the water's 30, you know, 32 degrees right at freezing, air temperatures in the 20s. And with the wind, and they had already been in the water, I think, like an hour in their Gumby suits, or maybe a little over an hour. So we had a discussion and discussed deploying the swimmer in the basket, which meant that we would pull up to a survivor, the swimmer would be in the basket, we'd lower him in the basket down, and he'd basically hop out, grab the survivor, stuff him in the basket, and then, you know, bring him up, and then we'd lower the basket down. So basically, we saved an evolution, a hoisting evolution every time we did that, which saved us time. So we get on scene, and, you know, it's blowing snow, you know, heavy seas, extremely windy. And I just remember seeing, like, one, the boat's not there. The visibility is somewhat limited, and you can see a raft way off in the distance, and where the boat was supposed to be, there was just nothing. There was some debris. And we did like an orbit, came around, and we saw like three survivors off to the side, away from any groups of anybody. So I elected to start there. And my assumption was that they were probably the first folks to abandon ship. So they'd probably been in the water the longest.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
So we went over, did our rescue checklists, and proceeded to recover our first 3 survivors. On scene conditions at that point, we try to use different modes, and the helicopter kind of support us. One of them is HOVOG, which uses like the rad out. Which gives you your altitude above the ground to steady your hover. But when you're hovering in blowing wind and snow like that, and it's pitch black out, we call it kind of like the Star Wars effect. So if you ever watch like Star Wars or different movies, and they're sitting there and they go to like warp drive, and all of a sudden the stars just like jump at you.
Yeah.
So when you're wearing MVGs at night, that's what it looks like all the time. And it's extremely disorienting.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so we're trying to do that and use different modes, and it just turned out that, you know, hey, the best way to do it is just to hand fly it, which, you know, proved challenging because the flight mechanic in the back's giving you conning calls to get to the survivor. You're trying to control altitude, and at one point I was up at like 140 feet, and the next thing I know I'm back down to 30 feet, and it's like, oh my gosh, it's just, you know, it was just pitch black out there. So we basically went through and recovered the first 3 survivors at that point.
Did they get debriefed in the back of the Hilo or anything, sir? How does that, you know, once you get them up there, I'm assuming that, you know, first aid measures had to be taken probably immediately due to the air temp?
Honestly, we really didn't have time. So, yeah. You know, in a normal case, yeah, you'd want to assess them. I mean, we were trying to grab live bodies. And so we're sitting there, I think it was the third guy we picked up, you know, the flight mech's like, hey, you know, he's scooting in the back. And what the guy actually did was he started crawling back into the tail boom. And, you know, 65 is very, you know, kind of small platform.
Yeah, there's all no sudden space.
I felt the nose pitching up. And I'm like, hey, what's going on back there, you know? And he looked back, and the guy had, like, he's a big dude. I mean, none, these guys aren't small. They're all probably 250, you know, 250 to 300 pounds. And then they have a wetsuit on or a Gumby suit full of water. And so they're pretty big guys. And so he had to move up a little bit because he was, like, crawling in the back where we usually store stuff. So, but, yeah, so anytime, you know, people move around a helicopter, you definitely feel the center of gravity move and shift aft, which makes it even harder because then you're trying to compensate that while you're flying. So, we picked up three survivors. And there were three that were kind of away from everybody. And then, you know, there's, you know, a bunch more folks in the water. We circle back around. And I remember flying over four individuals in the water, and they're all locked like arm in arm together. You know, they wanted to stay together. They figured that's the best survive, you know, best way for them to survive. And I did a low approach over them by like 50, 60 feet, and they waved. And I looked down. I'm like, these guys are in pretty good shape. I have another strobe at 12 o'clock. Let's go check that out. And so we marked the position of those four individuals, and then we proceeded forward probably about 500 yards or so, and we came upon this debris field with, you know, one strobe in it, and noticed that there was two survivors in that field. So we went through the checks again, lowered Abe down, and then during this recovery, it just took a long time, and the whole time I'm watching fuel. My co-pilot's, you know, he's talking to the C-130 overhead. He's getting comms between the boat, between Monroe, and the Monroe had stopped to Heifer and recover survivors from the 60 and Heifer because they needed fuel. So he's managing all that stuff, and I remember this hoist is taking a long time. And I'm looking down, and I asked the flight mech, like, hey, how's it going? And he's going through the conning commands and stuff. And just, it seemed like it took a lot longer. What I didn't realize is the survivor was very hyperthermic at that point, in and out of consciousness, and he was in a debris field. And there's two of them together. So a swimmer gets the survivor in the basket, and the flight mech starts to lift up the survivor. And as he's bringing him up, I'm trying to remember what the exact phraseology was, but he's like, the swimmer, he said the survivor's hanging outside the basket. And I was like, what? And so what happened was he brought the survivor up. He didn't have them in the basket, or he didn't have him. He was perpendicular in the basket. No, his legs were hanging out over the side. So, and with his Gumby suit, it was completely full of water. So as we brought him up, it basically, his Gumby suit pulled, and the weight of that water pulled him out of the basket. So the basket was on his butt. So he's like holding on to the bales of the basket as it came into the rail. Yeah. And this is, and I'm like, I'm blind. I can't see anything. I'm just hearing what everything's going on in the back. And this is what was later explained to me, what occurred. And I can hear the flight mech struggling in the back, trying to get this guy into the helicopter because he's basically holding on to the bales. And then, you know, shortly thereafter, I hear, you know, he's gone. I'm like, who's gone? He's like, the survivor's gone. And I started backing up and left. And at that point, the survivor had fallen from the basket and landed in the water below. So at this point, you know, the flight mech, you know, he's pretty distressed. He's giving me conning commands where the survivor's at. I pick up the survivor in the water and visually, and I'm looking at the guy. And you know, he's face down. It's like, you know, waves are washing over. I'm like, come on, dude, just turn over. And at one point, it's like, it looked like he was trying to maybe swim, but I think it was just like the motion of the waves in his arms. But, you know, at that point, we gave it, you know, some time, and he just never rolled over. In the meantime, the swimmer, you know, the basket went up with the survivor. He went on to the next guy. You know, he swam to the next guy. And I remember, you know, giving this some time, we're looking at our fuel state. You know, we're running out of gas. We had to drop our bingo down. And I told, I talked to the flight mech and I said, there's, obviously, it was kind of quiet. He was like, I said, we need to focus on the guys we can save. And, there was silence. And I said, are you ready? Or said, are you ready to continue? And he's like, yes, sir.
Yeah, it's so, rough. I mean, it's
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a rough conversation.
And he, he just, just jumped right back into it and, started giving me Connie commands for the swimmer. And we picked up that would be our fourth survivor, and brought him into the cabin. So, and then we lowered the basket down and picked up the rescue swimmer, and he came in, he was counting people, and he's like, and I don't know if he even realized that other survivor didn't make it into the cabin or not. We're real low on gas. I have four other guys behind me that I know are still alive. And we briefed, and the swimmer, Abe, is sitting in the basket. And I was like, hey, I want to leave you on scene. And I said, I want to leave you on scene with the raft. So he's kind of getting yelled at from the flight mech saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. And then I hear him say, yeah, leave me with the raft. I'm like, yeah, we're going to leave you with the raft. We're not going to leave you out there without it. So we circle back around to the group of four. And Abe stayed in the basket the whole time. We lowered him down. And he did a quick triage of the four individuals, grabbed one of them, stuffed him in the basket, brought him up. And then we readied our crew raft, and the flight mech, conned me into position, upwind, upswell. And like we couldn't have done any perfect, pulled and deployed the raft, activated the raft, kicked it out the door, and then that raft, hit the water and just drifted right back into those guys.
Perfect.
The three survivors and the swimmer, and then we transitioned to forward flight because we were like super low on gas at this point, and did one more pass, and we saw them climbing in the raft, and then we started beat feet back for back to Monroe. So.
And how many people did you have on board at that point, sir?
We had five survivors, so it was eight total in 65. It was pretty packed.
Right, that's tight.
And that's I know earlier we were talking about like how many could you hoist, right? And I mean, I always hear these stories about how many people were packed into 65s, and you had said mm-hmm. three was kind of the manual number.
It just depends how big the people are, because like I said, the cabin in 65 is very limited.
Right. Yeah. And then you start talking about like 250 pound guys. I mean, it's got to be
at least.
No wonder you're running out of gas, right?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, they're crawling in the back of the tail room.
Right.
Right. For their buddies, because it's like they're all comfy. It's like get in the back. We're not done yet. And it was. I remember as we transitioned to forward flight, and we're looking at our fuel state. And it was like, I remember looking back there and the green cabin lights on, and it's just like bodies everywhere. There's people packed in with their gumby suits on. And so we depart scene, and I remember I transferred the controls to my co-pilot, and Greg is flying it back. I'm looking at the fuel count, figure out what we have for fuel. And he had updated the position of the ship. And I remember calling CIC on the boat and on the Monroe, and they're like, hey, request your state. And I remember coming back to them, they're like, ETA, I'm like 40 minutes, and like time to splash, I'm like 56.
Wow.
They're like, there was like silence, and I'm like, hey, I needed to make up some distance. So this is when the 60s hyphering. And so they're sitting there like getting gas. They're all high-fiving each other, I'm sure, at this point. They're like, hey, we just, they picked up, I think, 12 survivors and, dropped them off of the boat. They're all happy. All of a sudden, from what they told me, is like they see the turbine fire up, and they're like, hey, what's going on? It's like, hey, you got enough fuel to get back? Because we got to go. And, the 65 fuel critical. We need to go get them. And so they terminated their hyphen revolution, and then they actually proceeded out the scene to pick up our swimmer and the other three survivors in the raft. The whole transit back, here I am. It's like, okay, we have 40 minutes to go. We slowed down to our max range speed. you know, knowing that the Monroe is going to make up some distance for us. But the whole time I'm thinking, it's like, all right, I've got 8 people in the helicopter. I don't have a raft anymore. I'm fuel critical. You know, what do you do? It's just like you're kind of stuck. So you're just trying to do whatever you can, like turn the heat off. You know, you have discussions like, well, you know, do we really save it? You know, do we save fuel if we bring an engine back? Not really. So it was kind of a high stress environment, for that transit back. But, we discussed it and we felt compelled to do everything we could to do that. And again, it goes back to being, with that crew and having an experience on Monroe that, they're not going to leave us hanging. So,
sure. I'm just thinking about, like, my sister likes to let the gas in the car go to like nothing. Right. And we'll be on I-64 and like the light's been on for a little while. And I'm like, dude, we need to pull this thing over, right? And I'm already getting stressed at that. I can't imagine. I mean, that's got to be a hell of a feeling.
And knowing that when you get back, you've got to put that thing down on a deck that's pitching up and down way more than it's supposed to.
So it was real quiet. You know, the transit back is real quiet. You know, we're going through our landing checks, getting everything ready to go. And we started picking up the tachyon off of the ship, so we knew exactly how far they were. And it was a little, I mean, they had made up a little bit of distance for us. So, you know, like, boom, I get a tachyon hit. I know they're at, like, 34 miles. I'm like, okay, boom, pop it in there, update it. Okay. And I remember when we went visual with the ship, and we said, we're talking back to CIC. We told them about our swimmer, the position where he was at, so they can relay that to the 60. And I remember calling Tally Ho. And that's basically, hey, we have you in sight.
Right.
And they're watching the DME tick down too. And I remember the best thing I think I've seen in a long time at that point was seeing that 378 just beat feet south, and all of a sudden it just came off plane and just like turned right into the seas to recover us. And you know, they start going through their stuff and like, hey, request a green deck. And it was just like, it was almost surreal because they turned into the seas, and we were on about a 3-mile final, and came in and landed, planted it on deck. We didn't, bother going to the from what I remember, going to the pitch and roll limits, because we knew they were well outside of the
limit. Right.
So don't have a choice at this point.
It's better if I don't know.
Yeah. I landed, and I remember as soon as I got on deck, we shut the aircraft down to take fuel, and I went down to CIC to brief the skipper on one, the lost survivor and what had happened, and then just to check on the rescue swimmer to see if anyone had heard from him, because we saw him climbing in the raft, but we didn't have comms with him because we were just too far away.
Right.
So we did that, and then the 60 had departed out. They ended up going back on scene, recovering the 3 survivors, which were in our swimmer, which were the last people recovered alive, and they were coming back. So we did a couple of different things. We ended up taking off again just to go out because they were still looking for somebody else. We made it about halfway to the scene, and then they recalled us to land. So, yeah, it was quite the night.
Yeah, sir. That's an unbelievable story.
Yeah.
Wow. What how did the debrief go with the crew? I mean, when did you have an opportunity after the sortie, after briefing the Monroe CO and whoever else in CIAC, did you have an opportunity to talk about, kind of what had happened, make sure each other were okay, or how did that go?
So we really didn't have the time. I remember going down to CIAC and waiting to hear that the 60 and this had Abe, the swimmer, on the radio. We knew he was okay, and I'm like, all right, I'm relieved at that point. I was kind of listening to stuff. Those guys, the rest of my crew, was trying to get the aircraft ready to go. Again, and then basically came back up and said, hey, we're still trying to find some people that are unaccounted for. We're going to go back out. Everyone was good, and we launched back out. It wasn't until after that sortie we came back, and I think what happened, I'm trying to remember, I think when we departed, we kind of stayed local and, around the ship for briefly because the 60 had come in, and at that point we didn't have a rescue swimmer, so we actually had them deploy their swimmer to the deck, and then we came in after them, picked him up, Brian O'Hall, and then proceeded back to scene. So then they went and unloaded all their stuff. So we did, kind of swap the swimmer around a little bit, and then, again, we got about halfway on scene, and then they had us, they recalled us. But it was kind of surreal. I mean, at that point, I think we finished up around 10 o'clock, 10:30 in the morning. I mean, we were all exhausted. I remember just going to bed, checking on the crew, make sure everybody's okay. I remember, reaching out, I think, to the command at that point back at Kodiak and saying, hey, we need obviously some Forest Services to meet us. We had to discuss the survivor that fell from the basket. Just a lot of stuff, and I was exhausted. And I remember going to bed, and somebody called. Maybe a good story to tell the commander, maybe not. But somebody called, and it's like, hey, the commandant's on the phone for you. And I was like, what? So I go down, and I go down to CIC, and I'm like, hey, Lieutenant Schmitz. And he's like, hey, this is so-and-so. We're trying to schedule an interview with you and the commandant, or a discussion with you and the commandant today. And I was like, I'm tired, just call back later. I'm with the bed. So, Captain Lloyd kind of handled that. And again, he was just a phenomenal skipper. So obviously he's working his channel. He knew what happened. I briefed him on everything. He did, everything that he could to take care of us. He arranged a team to meet us in Kodiak. They ended up standing up a MAD board for mishap for the survivor. So we had to kind of deal with that for a couple of weeks right after the case. So that was kind of a tough scenario or a tough situation to deal with, because at least for the crew, because people are getting accolades for the crew or for the accomplishment of the mission, and we're kind of like, yeah, but we got to go. We really couldn't talk about stuff because we had to go through this MAB process. Right. So as a leader, that's when I think doing the case, we're trained to do that kind of stuff, and it was just. It worked out well for us. It's just the piece of taking care of your crew afterwards that you have to really focus on. And I still keep tabs. We told the story, I think, in May at a unit where Abe Heller was there, the flight mech was there, and then the 60 representation from the 60 crew were there. And so we kind of all told the story of how this whole thing worked out. But yeah, so I think that's one of the leadership pieces that's kind of key in any kind of situation like that.
Yeah, 100%, sir. Because when it's, like he said, when you're there and you're actively going, and now we got a sortie again, it's easy to people, it's easy to kind of repress it, and then that after the fact thing when all the investigation comes, the feelings come, that's when it gets tough.
Well, it's got to be extra tough too, because you're getting accolades, and I mean you obviously did a great job. I mean, 18, 20 some people out of 47, you were able to save despite the conditions, but I'm sure probably for your crew anyway, it didn't feel like that much of a success, especially for that flight mech that actually watched that person fall. Like it would definitely be, I don't know how you deal with that. It's one thing if it's just the guy you didn't find or gal you didn't find. I think we all kind of expect that, or when you have to recover a body that, it's already a body. That's a pretty unusual experience for sure.
Yeah, you just got to know you did your best. Right. At the end of the day, that's what you guys did. You did your best, and you knocked it out of the park. Right. Things just went wrong on one.
And exactly, like I said, after that, he recovered the other guy that was with him, and then we came back and saved those other four guys. So, his ability to, keep stay in the game and stay focused on what he needed to do was just unbelievable. So,
well, sir, you hit all 3 points. We got dangerous, daring, and epic out of one story for sure.
I don't think that. Mic drop. Any other lessons learned from that particular case for you specifically, leadership or otherwise?
I think it was putting yourself in the right position at the right time and trusting the people around you. That's always key. Some of the other decision making process in the case where, I'd been in Detroit before and I've dealt with hyperthermic survivors, and I know that, growing up, being in the Great Lakes, these ice fishermen out there are big burly guys or gals, and they're not easy to handle. So, the flight mech that actually went that day wasn't the originally selected flight mech. And I had worked with them before, and, you know, they were both extremely competent, but the flight mech that went on the mission was, you know, he is a big farm boy. Like, you were like, hey, bend that for me. He's going to bend it for you. And I knew I needed that kind of, that kind of strength, that kind of person in the back. That paid huge dividends for us. And I remember going back after the case and the flight mech that was supposed to go on it, and I said, hey, you could love me or hate me for not, you know, selecting to go on that case, but I hope you understand why I did it. And he was like, nope, no questions asked. He understood. Right. So, and then the other discussion about, having the swimmer put on an extra layer of his undergarment, you know, under his dry suit, just to, you know, to help him in his, you know, survival situation when he was in that raft, paid huge dividends for him too. So it kept him warm. So, but like I said, it is what it is, and like I said, it worked out well for us. So,
for sure, sir. What a I'm gonna ask you a couple questions though before I let you off the phone. We have to.
Yeah, sure.
First, so what's better, being a pilot in the Army or in the Coast Guard?
Coast Guard. I mean, it's, you know, we are so mission focused, where, you know, the DoD services, they train to fight. If they're not fighting a war, they're not really training. You know, one of the things I value about the Coast Guard is the fact that, you know, one, we're doing the mission all the time and we're always training for it. We're extremely proficient at what we do, and it shows. I mean, anytime we get the call to go execute a mission somewhere, whether it's search and rescue, you know, mainly hurricane response, you know, our crews are ready to go and do that mission. And you can fly with anybody. Like, you can show up from Houston and go fly with another, you know, complete crew from Air Station New Orleans. And everybody is so standardized on how we do our mission that it's like you've been flying together for years. So, by far, I think as far as rewarding, and challenging and actually doing the missions, the Coast Guard is far better.
Solid, sir. Did you ever talk to the Commandant after the case?
I met him so we did the awards banquet. I think at that point, I think we kind of got wrapped in the MAB portion of it. And they were still trying to figure that out. I remember we went to New York for, I'm trying to remember awards banquet what it was. And I met him there. Yeah, it was kind of surreal that, you know, you're good, you know, you end up in that situation. But it was interesting.
Yeah, I'm just curious what he would have said.
Right.
I don't know. You know anybody that's got the call?
No.
No, I don't know anyone that's got the call. Interesting. What do you think he would have said, sir?
Bravo
Zulu. You can't leave it at Bravo Zulu.
Right.
Yeah. it was interesting. So one of the, you know, Senator Murkowski from Alaska actually read. I'm trying to remember what it was called. It's basically like it's a way of Congress to give the military accolades for a mission accomplishment. And it's a note that they read on the congressional floor and actually publish it. She did that for us, for the whole, everyone that was in part of that case. That was kind of cool. I got a copy of that.
No, very
cool. Fact, I just found it the other day. I want to get it framed. I got to meet, you know, at that time, Governor Sarah Palin and her husband Todd at the Alaska Awards dinner, and then we went on to New York the following year. As a matter of fact, I went to New York for I think it was an Ox Award, and I was fortunate enough to have at that time Rear Admiral Charlie Ray. Present the Ox Award to me, and, you know, now he's a Vice Commandant,
and probably one of the best presenters out there, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, he was a former 60 guy. He was a former Outback guy, I believe, and 65. And you know, everyone knows the Vice is this super personable, and I ran into him years later, and he was like, "Hey, how's your dad doing?" I'm like, "Oh, really good." that was kind of one of the highlights for me too during that whole process of having him there and doing that. So
very cool, sir.
That's really cool. Yeah.
Final question.
Sure.
Your first SAR case in the Coast Guard.
My first SAR case in the Coast Guard. It was in the Great Lakes. Like my first big SAR case, I think, is like a stranded ice fisherman on an ice floe, and that kind of gave me the hypothermic background. I do have another funny story, and it relates to the swimmer, Abe Heller. So he came out of rescue swimmer school, and they sent him to Alpat to be a swimmer. His first case was with me in Cordova. It was an overturned boat. And his second case in the Coast Guard was the Alaska Ranger.
Oh, wow.
It's like you said, drop the mic. And he's still in the Coast Guard now. He's had a phenomenal career. And to go, as that's your second SAR case in the Coast Guard, it was, he did a remarkable job. So.
Yeah, that's one of those guys you want to stay in duty with all the time.
Yeah, right.
He's probably a magnum for it. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Commander, we thank you so much for sharing that story with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Yeah, dangerous, daring, and epic, just like Bill said. I think amazing story, amazing performance by you guys, amazing willingness to put yourself in harm's way to get out there and make a difference.
Just everything the Coast Guard does, we just figured it out and went and did it.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate your service, sir. I'm sure everybody listening does. And we just thank you for sharing it with us.
Cool. Well, thanks for the opportunity, and I hope you guys all have a wonderful Veterans Day.
Awesome. Same to you, Commander. Let us know if we can ever do anything for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Bye.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.